You are listening to Myth Behaving, a podcast with a little bit of attitude on the literary world. Won't you come myth behave with us?
Hello, and welcome to Myth Behaving. This is episode number 33, and we are recording on July 20th, 2014. I'm Mayor Wilson, and I'm joined by my normal co-host and partner in crime, Miss Carla Clifton. Hey, hey, Carla, how are you today?
I tell you what, I'm doing pretty good. It's been a beautiful day today, and I have been peeling pears and getting ready to can them this afternoon after we finish this podcast.
Eating them sounds like fun, but the canning part, not so much.
You know, I'm just a country girl. I got to put up all these pears. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
The puppy is settling in, so life is good.
That's awesome. Well, hello, listeners. Each Myth Behaving show features a special guest from the literary world. It could be a writer, publisher, agent, editor, or anyone else connected with the world of publishing.
Plus, we have several special segments related to reading or writing.
Shh. Be very quiet when reading books in the library of a myth behavior.
And that means it's time for something from the library of a myth behavior. And today I'm recommending Heaven's Shadow. This is the first of a sci-fi series by Michael Cassett and David S. Goyer. This is such a cool series. I've read the first book already, and I am fascinated. It has a really big cast. They're varied cast, a lot of great characters. The pace is fast. I mean, you start, and you're just turning those pages. So that story and that pace is just very, very quick, just grabs you in right away, and you don't want to put it down. If sci-fi fans, this is a treat. If you have not read this series yet, you really do need to pick it up because this is an intriguing novel.
And that Miss Mean, our special guest today, is Michael Cassett. Welcome to the show, Michael, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm especially thrilled, obviously, because I had the pleasure of meeting Michael when I did the Big Orange Book Festival last year in October, and met Michael through friends, and I got to listen to him on one of the panels, and was just awesome. So it's very exciting to have you on, Michael. For our listeners, Michael not only writes novels, but he also writes for TV, and so we're going to have a little bit of a different slant today. So Michael, thank you so very much for joining us.
No, it's great. Looking forward to talking to you too. I hear great things about you, so I know you won't disappoint me.
Thank you.
Of Truth and Mythery.
Of Truth and Mythery is a segment where we take a commonly held publishing or writing belief and examine whether it's true or just another myth. Michael, please feel free to answer this. It's easy to break into writing for TV. Just have a good idea. Is that truth or just a bunch of mythery?
The idea that all you need in television or publishing for that matter is a good idea. Yeah, that's on the mythery side of truth and mythery. It's a complete myth. Yeah, you want to have a good idea, although I can tell you from 30 years of experience in television that the idea you think is brilliant, unique, and original is being pitched at the same time by somebody else who you've never met or never heard of. So there's that. But it is also, as anybody who's actually tried any real writing will know for truth, you need to, it's the execution of an idea. It's the development of an idea. It's the characters and whether people engage with them. So it's the idea, it's the execution, and that's half of the battle. The other is simply, it's those two wonderful things you can't control. One is just timing, having the idea come along at the right time. The other is sort of a little more mechanical, but it's access, is getting your well-executed idea at the right time to the right person, the right buyer, the right producer. So there are actually four or five different things at work, four or five different elements that control the success of any creative endeavor, whether it's a novel or a script.
I think you're one of the first people to bring up the timing thing, and that is just such an important element that we don't stop and think about, that maybe your book is going to be a great idea, or your TV script is going to be a great idea, or would have been 5 years ago, or will be 5 years in the future, but not always, it doesn't always connect at the right time for people. And that is something that I don't think many of us think of consciously anyway. It's a good point.
Well, it is probably not to be gained from fretting about it because you can't control it. But if you look at sort of the history of popular entertainment, the one example I always go to is Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain. Now, Crichton had published 6 or 7 novels by the time Andromeda Strain came out. They were all under pen names, very sort of well-done thrillers, including a medical thriller that later became a movie. But this novel about a plague from space, done with great verisimilitude and having the feel of a government report, happened to hit the bookstores the week of Apollo 11, which, by the way, we're celebrating on the day we record here today, the 45th anniversary of the moon landing. But that event and the discussions about, you know, putting the astronauts in these bio suits and in a trailer so they didn't infect the Earth with whatever they might have brought back from the moon, having that come along as your book is in the bookstores about a plague from space is what I would call really good timing. Crichton couldn't arrange it. It's very possible, I suppose, his publishers made sure the book came out because they were aware that there might be some timeliness to it. But that's the kind of thing that launches a career, and you really can't control it or anticipate it. There are all kinds of examples of brilliant books, brilliant scripts, brilliant TV shows coming out at just the wrong time. I mean, I was involved with a series called Max Headroom back in 1987 that was incredibly, I think, well done, interesting looking, smart, and was just literally 6, 7, maybe 10 years ahead of its time. If it had been on a different network in the mid-90s, it would have run for 7 years.
Yeah, it was a great series. I loved it.
I was talking about Max Headroom being moved from its prime position in spring, where I think we ran on a Wednesday night next to Moonlighting, which was a very compatible kind of show. So we were moved to a Friday night opposite Dallas and Miami Vice. And Miami Vice at that time was about the hippest happening show in TV history. It was very influential in terms of its editing, its production design, music. It had originally been pitched as MTV Cops, and that's what it was. So Miami Vice had good timing. Max Headroom did not.
Well, I agree with you. I think that timing is everything.
Michael, you have such a rich and diverse and really impressive career. In addition to Max Headroom, you've written for The Twilight Zone, The Dead Zone, Stargate, and even Beverly Hills 90210. These are just the tip of the iceberg for such an incredible list of accomplishments. Would you tell our listeners how you got your start and which came first, TV or novels?
Well, it would certainly be on the novel prose fiction side. Actually, what I started writing, what a lot of people my age started writing, were science fiction short stories and getting them published in the magazines and anthologies back in the 1970s. That said, I always had it in the back of my mind from probably the time I was 10 or 11 and thinking about writing. What I wanted to do was write television. I remember watching Lost in Space when I was 10 or 11 years old and thinking, this is really dumb. I could do this a lot better. Or I just thought I had a better version of that show in my head. So I was always aware that that was a goal, but I was living in a small town in Wisconsin, knew nobody who was a writer. I think it's kind of a miracle that I even figured out how to write and submit and ultimately sell a short story, much less get into television. That was a sort of an impossible dream that I, you know, somehow was able to put together after a few years. But it was novels and short stories and prose that came first.
It's time for MythPrint, tips and tricks of the industry.
Well, it's time for another one of our special segments. MythPrint includes a basic tip concerning writing, marketing, or anything else to do with the industry. Michael, what would you consider the most important tip that you can offer someone who wants to write for TV?
The most important tip, it's a couple of tips. One is basic and applies to any writing career, is keep writing. There are people who will write one magical spec script, whether it's a spec pilot or an episode, that would be a great sample. And they rest on it, or they figure this is the best I can do, or this is so good, everyone will see my genius and hire me or want to meet me. And then it gets into the whole question of timing and access. And my advice would be, since you can't control timing and your access is probably limited, you ought to just keep writing send some bread upon the waters. So the first one is just keep at it. The other is kind of goes to what you write. And this may even go back to that basic question about the idea and the uniqueness of an idea. There is no idea you've got that somebody else doesn't have. There are some very, very clever people just working in Los Angeles, just in the entertainment business here. If you expand that to the entire universe of people who want to write and then people who want to write television and film, other people are having the same idea you have. Trust me on this. And some of them will have better access and better timing. What you bring to any project is your particular vision anyway. So what you should do, I mean, it is sort of like the song in every Disney movie about a princess is follow your dream. There's a lot of truth in that. You should try to write the thing that you believe in the most, that affects you the most, that makes you hurt or love or cry the most, and do that as often as you can. And if you are persistent and are, I guess, honest in the work, you will at least be in a position to better take advantage of that mythical possible timing and access.
That's great advice. You know, writing is a process of so many things. What is it you love most about what you do, Michael?
Right now, what I love most is about writing is the commute. I can walk across the backyard to my semi-detached office most days. Even when I'm working on a series, generally the commute is slightly off rush hour, so it's not quite as bad as going to a regular office job. So the lifestyle aspect of writing for a living is appealing. Collecting the money and wondering where it is much less appealing. In that case, a regular job has it all. But in terms of just the process, there is something, I guess, very satisfying about, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe playing God, where you take an idea. This thing that really does apply to people who have a science fiction or fantasy bent, is you get to create a world and you get to populate it and you get to control the events, the triumphs and tragedies. So it is sort of the fun of taking a notion, a song, an image, and spinning it into a whole little pocket universe and then populating it and running amok.
That sounds just fascinating. And I've never looked at it from that perspective, because it is just exactly what you said. You know, you get to create your own world, and that's wonderful. Well, Michael, is there anything about the writing process that you don't like?
Well, I probably alluded to it in the answer to the things I do like. It's where's the money? Frederick Pohl, the very famous writer and editor and anthologist for years and years, said that it was a lesson he had to learn the hard way back in the 40s, is because he had gone from being a lowly paid freelance writer to a lowly paid editor to a slightly less lowly paid writer a couple of times. And he said he probably wound up making just as much money as a writer as he ever did as a salaried editor. But the thing about editing was he got paid every Friday. And the thing about writing, he said, is you get paid when they pay you and not a moment earlier. And for just the whole business of having a happy life and lifestyle, waiting for checks and chasing money, chasing markets is tiresome at best and terrifying at worst. So what I don't like about the idea about writing in that practical sense is the management of money and career. Beyond that, I don't know that there's a lot not to like, except for the probably just the potential, I won't say automatic, but the potential disappointment of writing something that you think or know is good and just having it not connect. I mean, forget not selling, but it's just people don't get it, or people just never hear of it. That would be the, you know, it goes back to that universe creation. You've created this world and nobody comes to play in it.
And I can only, from the way I would think about it, that would just devastate me. You know, that here I have this work and this world and it's wonderful. You need to come play. You need to come read it. You know, so I can see where that would be a part of the bad process. Well, authors work in so many different ways. Are you a planner, outlining and making extensive notes? Or are you a pantser, flying by the seat of your pants and just letting your book go wherever it will?
I've been both. I have written novels that I had 4 or 5 double space pages of thoughts, in essence, making it up as I go along. I've also written a novel that I had 45 pages of detailed outline for. The Seat of the Pants one, and actually had probably more plot twists than the other one. And I would say that it was a faster, probably more fun writing experience. On the other hand, working in film and television, for example, you really are not in a position where you can fly by the seat of your pants. There are too many steps in the process. There are too many other people involved. There's too much money involved. There are too many wheels or too many gears in the machine. If you're working on a television series, you can't just say, I'm going to go off and write an episode. I'll bring it in when it's done in 6 weeks. No. People have to have approved the basic paragraph premise. They'll want to have approved the outline. The outline will probably go to the production people so that they can start to look for locations, have a sense of the budget, decide, oh, there's a role here for a big guest star. We might want to do that. All those kinds of things need to happen when you're writing for production for a drama. So you really are not in a position where you can just fly by the seat of your pants. Outlining is mandatory. On the other hand, you can write a spec pilot and just wing it and see how it comes out. And sometimes it works pretty well. I've heard of that working. So I'm a little of both. I probably lean more toward the outlining or toward at least having some sort of scheme, some sort of structure. Certainly, even for even if I were to sit down today and say I wanted to write a spec 1-hour pilot, I would at least step out the first 4 or 5 scenes just to say, to establish in my mind who comes in when, who am I introducing, in what sense does each scene actually build? Have I established a story and a crisis, et cetera, et cetera? And I would want to know at least what the major, say, the end of Act 1, the end of Act 2 were. If I were really trying to do something for a broadcast network, I'd be thinking of a couple of extra act breaks because that's how those go. But I would say more toward the planner than the pantser, but pantsing is fun too.
That's, I hadn't thought about the TV portion having to be so planned, but that makes sense. That really does make a lot of sense. You know, Michael, do you mind sharing a little bit about your next project with us? What's next?
Michael Cassett's next project. Since last November, I've been working as the co-executive producer, also known as just basically a senior writer, on a new sci-fi channel series called Z Nation, Z as in zombie. And it is something very much in the spirit of Night of the Living Dead or World War Z or the incredibly popular Walking Dead. We think it's a slightly different take on those kinds of worlds, the sort of the zombie apocalypse and what's going, you know, what would happen to a small group of people in that world. Ours has a lot of motion, probably a bit snarkier than some of these other projects. It's in production right now in Spokane. The show is created and show run by Carl Schaefer, with whom I've worked many times. He's a vastly, vastly talented writer whose very first produced script called TV 101, a pilot for CBS back in 1988, not only became a pilot and a series, but won the Writers Guild Award as the best drama of the year. And he's gone on to create other shows, co-created Erie, Indiana back in the early 90s, another show called Strange Luck in the mid-90s, worked on Dead Zone, Eureka, and some other things like that. He is up there in Spokane right now writing Herd on dozens of zombie Spokaneans and the cast. So the show is also inspired by a Sci-Fi Channel TV movie of several years ago called Zombie Apocalypse, which was co-written by Craig Engler and Brooks Peck. And Craig is involved with the show as well. So that's the current thing. We're producing episode 7. The promo should start rolling off the Sci-Fi Channel site and network within the next couple of weeks, and I am reliably informed the series is supposed to start airing in September. So everybody be ready to watch so that I can go back and do a season 2.
Oh, that is so exciting, especially about the zombie apocalypse. I'm such a fan, so I can't wait to watch it myself.
Yeah, that does sound like a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to seeing this. And only also because I can say, oh, I know somebody who writes that. That's always fun, too. But you also have a new book coming out, too, do you not?
Well, yes, I do. In the next 2 or 3 weeks, the paperback edition of book 3 in the science fiction trilogy I did with David Goyer, Heaven's Fall, comes out from Ace. It's a series of books that David and I started working on 6 or 7 years ago. It was originally intended to be just one feature film idea, and the more we got into it, the more we convinced ourselves we were Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick. And so we would simultaneously do novel and screenplay stuff, and then also plan out the sequels, and we wound up writing them. The first volume, Heaven's Shadow, is in development at Warner's. All three books have been sold to Warner's for feature films, but the feature film wheels turn pretty slowly. So we're excited to have all of them out. Heaven's Fall came out 3 years ago. Heaven's War 2 years ago. Heaven's Shadow, the first one came out 3 years ago. Heaven's War in 2012. Heaven's Fall, the third book, came out last summer in hardcover and is now coming out in paperback. And Mayer was kind enough to describe the books as sort of classic science fiction, classic hard science fiction, one where you sort of pay attention to the rules of the universe, the kind of thing that Arthur C. Clarke and a Larry Niven, John Barley, Alan Steele would have done, and in some cases are still doing. So David and I deliberately wanted to write a story like that, and we think Heaven's Shadow, Heaven's War, and Heaven's Fall are very much in that tradition. So we hope that people who like those other writers and that kind of storytelling would scurry out and get all three of the books in paperback or on their e-reader or audiobooks. They're all available.
That's awesome. I'm a big audiobook fan because I have such a long commute, so I listen to most of my books on audio. So I can't wait to pick them up. So,
I love them. You know, Carla, they were just awesome, and as big a sci-fi fan as you are, I think you will really, really enjoy them.
Well, I have just written it down, and I'm adding it to my list. I am getting them, so... Anyway, well, we've seen a lot of changes in the publishing industry just in the last couple of years. Michael, how do you feel about the changes and how they may have impacted your own work?
Well, how do I feel about the changes? It's hard to say. I mean, I've reached a certain age now where I can look back on 40 years in publishing, and so I thought I had a handle on the way things worked, and just as I... was able to start operating the handles, the machine changed. So I have that sort of grumpy middle-aged male view of things as well. It's not the way I used to be, and the way it used to be was something I understood. I'm not sure I understand it now. I mean, I liked it when there were multiple publishing companies, not just three giant conglomerates, let's say. You had theoretically at least more markets. On the other hand, yes, there's a whole ebook world. There's a whole indie publishing world, self-publishing is huge and is an option. In fact, I have a couple of projects from time to time that I think, well, I'll just publish them myself, and I may yet. So, like anything, you lose certain things as systems evolve. On the other hand, things also develop more opportunities. So, it's pointless for me to sit around and complain about the good old days. All I can do is try to get hip and happening with what's going on now and embrace the inevitable, if nothing else. And maybe that sounds a bit negative or unenthusiastic. It's more an expression of this bafflement and not enough time to really experiment with it. All in all, it's certainly a more democratic publishing process right now, in the sense that anybody can publish anything to some degree and get it out there ostensibly or theoretically to an audience. So ultimately, I think that's probably good. The downside of that is there's so much stuff, it's difficult to know what's really good and how you get pointed to it. So, and that goes kind of back to my worry or my thing I dislike most about publishing, which is doing something that nobody sees. There is going to be more of that simply because there are more people publishing things in quotes and feeling that they ought to have an audience. They're just never going to find it.
That's a great answer. Makes a lot of sense.
The misnomer is...
And now it's time for Mythnomer, our word for the day. Today's word, in honor of Michael, is screenplay. So, does a beginning writer for TV need to have professional software such as Final Draft, or can they go with Word or something similar? And how important is properly formatting a screenplay?
I'm going to take those in reverse order. Writers on the outside of film and TV get hung up on the idea of format to a degree that is destructive. If you are writing a script and it follows a few basic rules and it in essence looks like any script you've seen, you're probably going to be all right. There are, do you put the slug lines in bold or underline them? Well, Tony Gilroy does for the movies he directs. That's fine. Other people don't. I mean, the simple rules are slug lines are all in caps and they indicate locations or specific shots. The narrative, the action is in prose and stretches across the page just like any manuscript. Dialogue is in the middle with smaller margins. And the reason the smaller margins are there is because the same reason it's for the same reason newspaper columns are the same, are the width they are, is it's faster to read. And in the case of actors, it's easier to learn. So if it looks like that, it's going to be fine. So don't get hung up on it if it has at least those same basic rules. In terms of just your writing, I have found it to be vastly easier to use a script writing software to do a script. It's a lot easier than doing hard returns and everything in Microsoft Word, especially the later Microsoft Words, where you've got autocorrect and auto formatting that will drive you insane. You'll be better off. If you're going to get driven insane, get driven insane by Final Draft 9. But the fact remains is Final Draft really exists for two reasons. The basic one is it does make it easier to simply type a script. The real reason it exists, though, is to help scripts through production. And as a beginning writer, that's not your concern. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to have scene numbers. You don't have to have revisions marked. You don't have to have any of those. You don't have to have A pages and B scenes and all that kind of things. That's what Final Draft will do for you. So, I mean, there's no requirement to have it. I just think you'll find it easier to write your script, or at least complete your first draft or your drafts when you've got it. Because ultimately, you're going to turn the thing into an Adobe PDF anyway, and because that's how it'll be read.
Good to know.
Well, here comes the fun part, Michael. If you could have a dinner party with any seven people, living, dead, or fictional, who would you include?
Well, let's see. Not the seven dwarfs. And not the seven Mercury astronauts, because I actually have had dinner with a couple of those. And allowing for the fact that I think seven is an awkward number for me for a dinner table, it means I'm not getting a chance to talk to somebody. But those aside, The one actress I've always wanted to have dinner with is Emma Thompson. The one actor I've always thought would be fun to have to dinner was Humphrey Bogart. So that'd be kind of my showbiz contingent. A writer I would have loved to have met and had dinner with is the English author Kingsley Amis, who wrote Lucky Jim and The Old Devils, which would probably be a bad idea because he probably would have hated me. He got very kind of tough to deal with, became a very grouchy individual a little later in life. Beyond actors, actresses, writers, one person I actually have met a couple of times. I've admired him since I was 13 and at one point contemplated a career like his is the songwriter Jimmy Webb, who wrote By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Wichita Lineman, MacArthur Park. Just someone I've always liked. I actually had a chance just to see him in concert here in Los Angeles about 3 weeks ago. It was a fabulous evening. In terms of others, I would have loved to have dinner with my grandfather, Clyde Williams, who died of emphysema when I was 12 years old. And somebody I look like, that the story in the family was, Mike looks like Grandpa Clyde. And when long after he was gone, I got a hold of his the picture of him from his wedding day and laid it next to my high school graduation picture. And if you allow for some difference in hairstyle and men's collars, we look like the same individual. So I would have enjoyed actually having dinner with him in adulthood. Beyond that, you know, it's interesting. You think, well, have dinner with Jesus or dinner with Napoleon, but I don't speak Aramaic or French or whatever Napoleon spoke. So I don't think that would have been, you know, we wouldn't have gotten much past the bread.
Well, that was an interesting party all the same.
I like that party.
Me too.
Michael, what question do you never get asked in interviews that you really wish someone would ask you? And what would your answer be?
Well, the joking version is, would you like this large sum of money? And the answer is always yes. The question I never get asked, that is a good question. Perhaps this is something I teach from time to time, and I find this question coming up a lot with beginning writers, is that there's always going to be a disconnect between what you want to do and what you think you're good at and what you're actually good at. And that's something I've been struggling with all my life. I've had people telling me since I was 18 or ask me, why are you wasting time with this science fiction crap? You should be writing Catch-22 or Kingsley Amis style modern comic novels. And I don't know that I actually need to have that question asked, but it's, I suppose the question I might ask of almost any writer is, what is it you think you're good at and what is it you might actually be good at? Is there a difference?
Oh, I like that. That's different.
Well, Michael, everyone has their own personal myths. Things a lot of people think about us that may or may not be true. Their own personal myth behaviors. What myth behavior do people believe about you that is absolutely not true?
Well, allowing for, to me, the unlikely possibility that people are actually thinking about me, aside from my relatives, in the business, in school, I do find that people tend to think of me as sort of dark and cynical. And I could probably come off that way. I have a fairly dry sense of humor. I'm actually one of the most cheery, optimistic people you'll ever run into. Even saying that, it probably sounds like I'm being dark and cynical, but really, no. I wish for and assume the best with people. I generally wish people wish good things for people and hope for good things for me and mine. The darkness sometimes comes in when people say, well, do you think something good is going to happen? And I usually can cite a few reasons why something might not. And I'm usually right. But that said, the core is optimistic and happy as opposed to dark, dreary, you know, sitting alone, drinking and smoking and complaining about the universe. That's not me, no matter what people might think.
Now, see, when I got to meet you, I would have never gone on the dark side on you, because I got to meet that very upbeat, very cheerful. We had loads of fun. So, yeah, I'm glad I got to see the cheerful, real you.
The darkness comes in often in professional circumstances. When you're working on a show, people will say, you know, this is just, well, the network has raised a question about this. But we're going to fight them. You know, we're going to go to the mattresses on this. And I will be the one who says, no, you're not. Well, you can, but you're wasting your time, because I know what those kinds of problems are. And this is what they're really saying, even though they're telling you X, it's actually Y, and Y is out of their hands. It's a business thing. You know, so I'm sometimes the voice of, I call it the voice of reason. Other people call it the voice of darkness, but, the record is on my side in a lot of those situations that I was actually the voice of correct prediction.
See, I would have just called that being a realist. So I'm on your side here, Michael.
I do feel that my approach is realistic, tinged with hope. How's that?
Oh, I like that. That sounds good. All right. Now, what myth behavior do people believe about you that really is true?
That I'm witty and charming.
And that's true too. I can vouch for that.
Guilty, officer.
Well, I can tell you from this interview, I agree.
Thank you.
Well, Michael, this is the end of our show. Thank you so much for being our guest. We appreciate all the wealth of information that you've shared with all of us.
Well, thank you. It's been fun, and it's been great talking to you again, Mayor, and meeting you.
And we do thank you for taking time to be with us today. I think you've given us a fascinating look at what you do and what happens behind the scenes, both in your series and your other projects. And I'm looking forward to both the new TV show and reading the rest of your series.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, remember, everyone, you can go to mythbehaving.com for more information about Michael Cassatt and links to his books. You can also read his bio and find links to his social media.
And don't forget, you can download this episode on iTunes or listen to it right on the mythbehaving.com website.
Well, please take a moment to leave us a positive feedback on iTunes. That's how we move up the iTunes ladder.
And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Myth Behaving. We'll see you again next time. I'm Carla.
And I'm Mare, and we are Myth Behaving, where reality meets fantasy. See you soon.